It's a Central Pittsburgh. I'm Paul Guggenheimer. The state budget impasse in Pennsylvania is now in its seventh month. You've probably asked yourself more than once, how can this thing continue to drag on? Why isn't there something in place, some mutually assured destructive thing to prevent it from happening? Well, there is, but just not in Pennsylvania. As Pittsburgh Tribune Review reporter Natasha Lindstrom points out, Pennsylvania, unlike many other states, has virtually no consequences when lawmakers fail to pass a budget on time. So what happens in states like Ohio and Maryland when budgets are late? Natasha Lindstrom joins us in studio. Hello, Natasha.
Hello. Thanks for having me today.
Good to have you back with us. And you can join the conversation at 412-246-2002. That's 412-246-2002. Email is ESSPGH@WESA.FM and on Twitter at ESSPGH. What do you think should be in place to prevent long budget delays like the one we're currently experiencing from happening? 412-246-2002, the number to call. And Natasha, I don't know if it's going to make people feel any better or not when they learn that what's happening here in Pennsylvania is unusual among the 50 states. Why is this unusual, what we're experiencing here?
Well, for one thing, it's also unusual for Pennsylvania. It's the longest budget impasse we've had in at least 40 years.
We've set a record.
And also, most states do pass budgets on time. If they are late, it's usually a few weeks. So this is really unusual just in how long this has stretched on. And Pennsylvania is also unusual. A review found recently, a research review by the Greater Pittsburgh Nonprofit Partnership, who's been especially concerned about how this is affecting their agencies, that really a majority of other states do have different kinds of things in place, whether it be laws or restrictions or ways to really force lawmakers to not extend budget impasses this long. In Ohio, for instance, all facets of government shut down completely, just about, except for extreme public safety items.
All aspects of government.
So, all aspects. And this happens in actually more than 20 states. Impasses trigger almost complete shutdowns, which means furloughing all non-critical employees, which means they shut down, they close parks, they shut down driver's license centers. They do a lot of things that would affect people more in their everyday lives that would be noticeable.
That would cause people to scream and say, you know, look, I got to get my license, or I want to go to the park. That in the middle of, today wouldn't be a good day to do that necessarily, but in July when this began, you know, you had 2 months of summer left. So if people weren't able to go to state parks, there would have been an outcry, wouldn't there?
There's that. That's one of the arguments. Then there's also other rules on the books in states where especially a lot of part-time legislatures where they actually cannot adjourn until a budget is passed or, you know, some kind of funding stream is at least approved. Pennsylvania is also unique that we're the most expensive legislature in the nation, and we're one of the largest. Only New Hampshire is larger than us with 400 members. We have 50 in the Senate and 203 in the House, which also makes consensus building challenging.
I've had a chance to live in some other states. South Dakota is one of them. In South Dakota, they have a 40-day legislature. They're part-time people, which may or may not be a good thing. And they come in you know, say January the 10th or so, and they work through until late February. They come back somewhere around St. Patrick's Day if there's unfinished business, things to be left that have been left unresolved. They deal with them then, and that's it. So regardless of whether you think that the big government, small government, a part-time legislature, or full-time legislators is the way to go, how much does the fact that we have, you know, a professional legislature, a large, you know, two large bodies, the House and the Senate, and, you know, all of these folks in the mix with different interests, and does that make it harder for everybody to agree because you have more people?
I think it certainly does, particularly in our House because it's just so large, 203 members. But there's also, it's not even just a two-party split. We have a four caucuses, which also sometimes are disagreements among the caucuses. In this case, the Senate Republicans had come to an agreement with Governor Wolf, what would have passed a full budget. It was rejected by the House Republicans. Some say the Senate Republicans were willing to give up too much. But again, it's not only, there's also division within parties when you have such a system like this. There's some have pointed to effective methods in other states, such as New Jersey. They use a lot of nonpartisan legislative staffers, for instance, to try to you know, make it a less of a partisan problem in terms
to
not
build. Is that a better way to build consensus?
I think that's one of the arguments made, because you try to have a lot more of a nonpartisan research and analysis and guidance, as opposed to there being a separate lawyer for the Republicans and the Democrats in each caucus, where it can, you know, there's a lot. It can be hard to weed out what's true, what's not, from such a four fire hoses of information coming at you once.
Right. Well, here's one thing that we've heard, and I'll bounce this off of you, and you tell me what you think, that there are five entities involved in this. You have the governor, you have the House Democrats, House Republicans, Senate Democrats, Senate Republicans, and that four of the five have reached a consensus on this, that it was the House Republicans who basically blew this thing up. Is that oversimplifying it?
The House Republicans would say, you know, they've also taken a big issue with the Senate Republicans for you know, basically agreeing to concessions that the majority of the House caucus was not willing to do, primarily relating to Wolf's plan around tax hikes. Mm-hmm. A lot of Republicans in the House particularly, you know, don't want to also disappoint their constituents by going against their pledges not to raise taxes. You know, that there, any both sides might make that argument. Of course, the Wolf administration is making that argument, the House Republicans would disagree. They would say they've already sent Wolf a few budgets along the way that he vetoed, and that we could have resolved this impasse sooner.
412-246-2002 if you want to join our conversation with Natasha Lindstrom of the Pittsburgh Tribune Review, who has written about what is happening or what happens in other states when there is a budget impasse. There are things in place that prevent it from dragging out like it has here. You talked about what happens in Ohio, Natasha. Let's listen to what you've found out from some of the other states, Maryland, California, Virginia. There's interesting things happening in all of those places. Let's talk about what goes on there.
California especially is interesting to note. They actually went as far as contemplating removing the governor and lawmakers from office if they fail to pass a budget on time. That was kind of scrapped when they realized that special elections could be too cost prohibitive. Instead, they have done things such as now their constitution prohibits lawmakers from drawing any kind of travel or living expenses until a budget gets enacted. That's definitely something that most voters seem to want.
That's hitting them where it hurts.
And there has been a proposal to do that in Pennsylvania. State Senators Randy Vlakovich of Shaler and Senator Rob Teplitz introduced legislation to do that. Although I will say a lot of the experts say, well, that's maybe a symbolic thing to do. It's not really proven effective to actually resolve a budget impasse. It's simply withholding lawmaker pay. Now, last time around we had a budget impasse in 2009, state employees weren't getting paid. And that did ramp up a lot of pressure. There were a lot of, you know, drumbeating union supporters on the steps every day. So that probably did help. In this case, it was schools and nonprofits that weren't getting paid, and they probably have, you know, less public influence, less lobbying power. And so that's partly why the Greater Pittsburgh Nonprofit Partnership has told me they're in the process of joining with a bunch of other foundation leaders, business leaders, religious groups to try to create this new statewide coalition to really try to get the dialogue moving about substantial reform on the state budget process. Though I've been told that that's really unlikely as things stand in Pennsylvania right now. It's really, for one thing, it's not in a lot of legislator self-interest, and there isn't really strong pressure to do so. In a state like California, where they have the ballot initiative process, that's how they got some of this going, where you can actually have voters can, you know, if they get enough signatures, you can put almost anything on the ballot. Pennsylvania doesn't have something like that. So it's can be a lot tougher for real change to happen.
And how much is the fact that we haven't seen people with signs picketing, protesting at the state house? If we had, there really hasn't been any of that, has there, during the course of this last 6 or 7 months? If we saw more of that, would that have an impact?
I mean, you certainly, if we were in the state capitol every day, we'd certainly be seeing those conferences going on, and the nonprofit community and others in the education community, you know, would say they have taken real steps, but that mean, you know, maybe just enough constituents have been calling in. My colleague, our capitol respondent, and a few others have told me in the state capitol that lawmakers really start to pay attention maybe when they get, you know, 7, 8, or 9 calls from individual constituents, not necessarily a part of an organized group or some postcard campaign that actually care about something. So that may be part of it, that, you know, the groups that are lobbying just don't have enough influence over lawmakers as it stands.
So really what part of the problem here is that in Pennsylvania, you see things continue to function. Schools are still open. The state employees are getting paid. The lawmakers are getting paid. Everything somehow seems to be running. Now, that might be different if it hadn't been for the stopgap measures that the governor took at the during the holidays there, you know, just before the end of the year. But even with that having been done, or even if it hadn't been done, it's not like everything grinds to a halt here. And I'm wondering what some of the people that you interviewed, Natasha, are saying about what needs to happen to force people to get back to the bargaining table.
Yeah, and just so I guess for a quick update on where things stand, as I guess the current negotiations lines are kind of going, House Republicans are saying, you know, we have a budget, we have a partial spending plan in place, so we're it's fine, we can
relax. We're moving
a bit.
On, and as far as they're concerned, anything that the governor didn't finance, then he just vetoed the funding, or he just simply is not providing the funding for it.
Right, and we will have to now when it comes. So for some of those things, schools and corrections, particularly, there's only 6 months of funding in place for those now. So come around March or so, the pressure point will start beating to resolve that. But even in the meantime, Wolf is scheduled still February 9th to unveil his budget for the next year, so 16-17. So there's still going to be a lot going on. I've kind of heard it described that, you know, maybe Pennsylvania, we're kind of going to be like Washington, D.C. for this year and maybe even next with partial funding and some more vetoes. And, you know, it's not going to be quite a normal budget.
Well, it's getting to be a mess because you can't really, it's almost as though you can't follow what's going on because one budget is blurring into another budget and it is becoming more and more confusing. What are you hearing from people in Harrisburg about whether anything can be done before the governor delivers his budget address? And how does he even deliver a budget address when there isn't a budget now?
Yeah, well, I mean, he's probably going to pretty much propose the same thing he proposed last year, you know, the things he didn't get done that time. He's going to probably, again, criticize the current deal falling through, criticize House Republicans for not going through that compromise. And there's going to be some, you know, ongoing debate over the primary issues around tax hikes and pension reform and some of the big sticking points that have, you know, resulted in or prevented in this from getting done sooner.
We're talking with Natasha Lindstrom of the Pittsburgh Tribune Review. Her story about what happens in other states when the budget is late. 412-246-2002 is the number to call if you want to weigh in and share ideas. Maybe people have just run out of ideas at this point, but there are things that can be done. Two-thirds of Pennsylvanians that have been polled about this, and you reported on this in your article, Natasha, two-thirds of Pennsylvanians think lawmakers should give up their pay when a budget is overdue. Would this help, do you think?
So, as I touched on, that is something that's widely popular, you know, among people. People want that to happen. And to be fair, there have been lawmakers. I'm not sure quite the number. It's a little tough to pinpoint who have given up their pay now amid this impasse. But in terms of the larger body of research and experts I talked to, they said that's less effective at actually ending an impasse than other measures out there. And I will say in some of these things that maybe would really cause the most change, whether it be from term limits to doing something like New Jersey's non-legislative staff to kind of bigger changes, take a lot of time, something constitutional amendments. So some of the groups are focusing on, well, what are some shorter term fixes we can do to at least prevent some of the things that happened this time around? Like preschool started shutting down in late October. There was a report of a domestic violence shelter in Harrisburg that had turned away over 100 women.
Right.
So, you know, you could be arguably say that there were real consequences to this impasse. Schools borrowed $1 billion and are suing the state because of that right now. A lot of nonprofits are still having to, you know, maybe take back workers they laid off and deal with their own debts. So they're one of the lines of conversations is also about, OK, if we're going to have this late budget, is there a more effective process for prioritizing money and to make sure that those, core services serving health and welfare don't get, you know, blocked out like they did this time. They don't just become bargaining blocks in a larger partisan, you know, debate.
Well, it sounds like there's sort of this fine line that the politicians in Harrisburg have to walk, because they don't want things to shut down. I mean, clearly the governor, we talked to the governor about this when women were being turned away from domestic violence shelters. That was something that he was clearly pained about. Clearly this was something that was an embarrassment to him, as it should be to all of the people in Harrisburg that are presiding over this mess. So I guess, is there a decision that they have to make about how far to let things go? Because if they shut everything down, it might force people back to the bargaining table, but it hurts a lot of average citizens.
It's true. And so it's constant, that tug and pull versus how much, you know, which types of pressure you want to use or leverage to try to get what you want accomplished. I know Governor Wolf never anticipated it going on this long.
I don't know. I don't know that anybody
but,
did.
Yeah. But a lot of Republicans will say, hey, he didn't have to cut off funding to those things. He could have approved emergency funding earlier on. So
he'll say in response, well, we had a budget and the House Republicans blew it up. Let's go to the phones. 412-246-2002. Let's hear from some of the people who are affected by this, our listeners, starting with Michelle in Braddock Hills. Hi, Michelle. You're on with Natasha Lindstrom. How are you?
Hello. I hope I can be succinct and help you to understand how I feel, because I'm so emotional about this. But both of my grandchildren, one goes to Pitt and the other goes to Point Park. They're rooming together in Oakland, and they were utilizing some of their FIA funds to pay for the rent. And now, since July, that's been withheld. Now, Pitt went ahead and allowed that they would still give this funding and they would catch up later when the budget's passed. But Point Park would not do that. So they sort of robbed Peter to pay Paul and used the one child's funding. But now even that's running out. So then there was a loan that was taken, and they're going to have to leave school. I mean, there's nothing else left to do. And I never hear about this higher education loan funding and how it's affecting students. And the callousness of politicians to not think about their actions. Why wasn't emergency funding given? You know, I'm too emotional about it.
Well, Michelle, hang in there with us, and we hear you and we understand your pain. Clearly there are others who are going through the same situation you are, so you are not alone. But this is clearly a point of frustration for you and others. Michelle, just stay on the line with us. Natasha, what about that funding? I mean, how does the legislature or the governor decide, okay, we'll provide this emergency funding, but you know, people like Michelle is talking about are left in the lurch?
And so I'm not exactly aware of the particular stream of funding or grants you're talking about, but kind of more broadly, too, I think it is worth mentioning one of the things that has no funding right now in the partial spending plan that's been passed is appropriations for the state-funded universities, which I've heard is less of an issue because they do get a majority of their money from tuition and grants. I'm not exactly sure of the stream you're talking about, too, related to Point Park, but it sounds like it was amid this, you know, it was over $700 million that was held up just for nonprofits and schools alone. So I know there was many more grant programs that were also stalled and delayed and are currently backlogged right now because of this. But again, it goes back to what we've been talking about, the prioritization of funding. The things that did get funded were things, you know, like public safety. The state employees now have to get paid, so liquor stores stayed open. Those kind of things continue to run. But as you're pointing out,
liquor stores close down in this state, I don't. Michelle, have you contacted anybody to express?
My daughter says that she has contacted both the schools and emailed the governor, and both of the students have emailed the governor. But I just honestly have not heard a lot about the possibility that students would not be able to complete their schooling and the fact that, you know, the funding affects people in that regard.
Well, you brought this to light, Michelle, and we appreciate your call and hang in there. And we hope that things are resolved soon and that this works out. But I'm sure Michelle in Braddock Hills is speaking for a lot of other people. James couldn't stay on the line. James from Pittsburgh says we should shut down the state stores. So there you go. Let's go to Deb in Ben Avon. Deb, hi. Welcome.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. I work at a social service agency that sponsors a school, and we are suffering greatly from the impasse. And actually listening to the comments about the state system, our government is even more frustrating around what can we do. And actually, the other thing I was going to say is close the liquor store, so my thunder was stolen. But really the frustration I think many of us have, you commented on how the nonprofit lobbies, GPNP and others, don't carry the swing in Harrisburg that some other lobbying organizations do. So as caring folks who are part of a nonprofit organization and as taxpayers and voters, what can we do to influence change so that this doesn't recur?
Well, you know, there have been others like yourself from nonprofits who have talked about this. Deb, I would ask you, what is your organization doing? Have you had to borrow money? Are they simply laying people off? What's going on?
It's been a combination of those. And so we have deferred services. We have certainly tapped into lines of credit, and we've had to change our workforce. And it hurts people, and it hurts people not only who aren't getting the services they need, but it definitely hurts the employees, both who have lost positions and those who are left behind, you know, trying to do the best we can. And this has been going on for so many months. I mean, when we were in September and October, the thought of closing down parks, you know, or something like that seems so long ago. So I think the difficulty and the frustration in great part is that the power in Harrisburg to influence change is very difficult for us to tap into. But yes, we have had to take a number of actions.
Well, Deb, we certainly sympathize and appreciate your call. And Natasha, what recourse do people like Deb have?
So one thing I would say, the reason a group like GPNP was formed is for this very reason. It's the advocacy arm for the Pittsburgh Foundation. And increasingly, a lot of foundation leaders have been trying to say, hey, let's be real, you know, let's step up. There was a big press conference even formed with the likes of Bishop David Zubik from the Catholic Diocese and others are getting involved, where they're saying, we it's time that we try to be heard more, figure out, you know, that they've been doing a lot of campaigns and have had some success in social media and other ways. But I think beyond that, I think you can't just depend on those kinds of groups. And like I said, with a lot of lawmakers paying attention to what their own constituents are telling them, you know, it could just take a lot of individuals kind of reaching out and just making sure your lawmakers are really aware of the situation and how it's affecting you guys in their home districts. One of our longtime veteran Capitol reporter, Brad Bumstead, told me that the most public pressure he's ever seen placed on legislature was following the legal pay raises they gave themselves in 2005. And that did bring about, at least for a short-lived one, a lot of reforms and changes because of just the outpouring of constituents calling in. So it's going to really take some really strong pressure, I think, to really bring about any substantial change.
Let's take a call from Monty in Pittsburgh with a suggestion. Hi, Monty. You're on with Natasha Lindstrom.
Just want to point out that this sort of budget impasse never happens in Canadian provinces, or for that matter, the Canadian federal government, because it functions under a parliamentary system, which means that the head of government, in this case the governor, is automatically the head of a majority of the legislature. Now, this would be a radical change to Pennsylvania's constitution, but there's nothing either in the federal constitution or at the Pennsylvania level to bar Pennsylvania from adopting a parliamentary form of government. So if Pennsylvanian voters are fed up with this sort of repeated budget crisis, they should at least consider this as an option. That's all.
Monty, you sound like you are from Canada.
No, I'm not.
No.
I married a Canadian, so I'm familiar with how the system works there, but I'm not a Canadian. I'm an American.
Okay. But you don't sound like you're from Pittsburgh.
No, I'm not. I'm from the West Coast.
Okay, all right. I knew there was a non-Pittsburgh accent going on there, but have you spent much time up there?
Yes, I have lived north of the border.
And so this sort of thing doesn't happen up there?
Because the premier, who is the equivalent of the governor here,
right,
automatically is chosen by the party which has the majority in the legislature. And so he can pass a budget or else he won't be premier.
So, Natasha, what do you think?
I think that's an interesting point to look at. I will say that I would say not just strictly having a governor and a majority party being the same doesn't necessarily guarantee consensus. If you recall, Governor Corbett, we may not have had the budget issue problem, but he was unable to get accomplished his full Big Three agenda, which included pension reform and liquor privatization.
That's a great point. And you mentioned
disagreements within Republicans. They had a majority.
Inter-party squabbles. Let's take one last call from Shannon in South Hills. Hi, Shannon. Welcome. Shannon, are you there?
Yes. I'm calling to determine if either you or your guests have any position on the amount of influence you think Alec has had on our state legislator being at deadlock, or if that's the right expression. And it's happening all over the country, but also nationally.
ALEC, the American Legislative Exchange Council.
American, what is that called?
American Legislative Exchange Council, ALEC?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
Well, what about it, Natasha?
I think that might be getting, that's definitely, a powerful interest in national politics, but I don't know how much that really relates to this particular impasse. People have pointed their ties to trying to spread things like pension reform and other policy-oriented issues, but that might be getting a little too much into the weeds of the kind of impasse issues we're talking about here.
Sure, and there's a lot left to be resolved. We're going to be hearing about this a lot more, but I want to thank all of our listeners for their very good questions and comments. And Natasha Lindstrom, who has been our guest, for your reporting on this issue for the Pittsburgh Tribune Review and for joining us today. It's good to see you again, and we appreciate your making it in on this very cold day in Pittsburgh on a very hot topic.
Thanks. It was great to be here.
Coming up, more small towns are dissolving their police department. So who's picking up the slack? It's Essential Pittsburgh on 90.5 WESA.